On this episode of the Edge Podcast, ClearEdge CEO and founder Leslie Vickery talks with Teresa Carroll, a staffing industry icon who spent nearly 3 decades at Kelly Services, most recently as Executive Vice President, President of Global Talent Solutions, and General Manager of Sales, Marketing, and HR. Teresa shares why she embraces a people-driven philosophy, how she created new business lines and orchestrated turnarounds in her tenure at Kelly, and dives into her passion for networking and promoting women in leadership. She also offers an inside look at what's next in her storied career. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone. This is Leslie Vickery, the CEO and founder of ClearEdge Marketing, and it is my absolute pleasure to welcome Teresa Carroll to the Edge Podcast, our first podcast of 2020. Welcome, Teresa.
Happy New Year. I can't believe it's 2020. It's so nice to be able to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, we're absolutely thrilled to have you here. And Teresa, you were most recently an executive vice president at Kelly Services, president of their Global Talent Solutions operating segment, and GM of sales, marketing, and human resources for the whole company. I've known you for several years. Of course, I've seen you keynote at events and more, but I've known of you for several years. I haven't gotten to know you very well until recently, when thankfully Robin Mee suggested that we meet, and Robin's the founder of Mee Derby. And I had asked Robin a couple of words about you, and she basically called you a staffing industry icon and a dominant force in the transformation of the company, once known as Kelly Girl, into a modern talent management solutions company. And that just speaks volumes. Many of us who have been in the industry for our entire careers and so forth remember Kelly Girl, and just to be with you here today and knowing what a wonderful role you've played in the industry, it's fantastic to have you here. So Teresa, you spent the better part of your career at Kelly and are now embarking on your next move, which I know many listeners are going to be curious to hear all about. But before we jump into what's next, I'm hoping perhaps you can share a bit about your passion for engineering and how it helped you launch a career in staffing.
Well, engineering, not the path to staffing that most people take. But what happened was I was good at science and math in school. I wanted to be an algebra teacher. And unfortunately, I couldn't afford college. I wasn't in a family situation that would allow me to go to college. So I talked to my high school counselor about it and said, I really do want to go to college. And he helped me find a way to go by being an engineer. He said, you would be really good at engineering. I said, I want to work with people. He said, well, engineers can work with people. So I picked industrial engineering, and he helped me find a path to a 5-year co-op school, which meant that I worked all 5 years while I also went to school, and I was able to fund my way. I graduated and worked in the automotive industry after that for a few years, but then I decided, you know, I really have no interest in how a car is made. So I decided to leave to find a more people-oriented business, and I landed in one of the most people-oriented businesses out there. Staffing. It's really the path I took. And I really feel engineering is about solving problems. That's what we're taught. Business has its fair share of problems. So I'm happy to say I've spent 35 years in big companies, first with General Motors and then with Kelly Services, and happy to be associated with the Kelly Girl brand and all that it stands for.
Oh, good. Well, industrial engineering, definitely not the easiest subject to study. So certainly preparing you for a strong background in, as you mentioned, problem solving. And certainly as you look to transform an industry, there's a lot you can take from technology engineering, all of those industries to help on the business and operations side. In fact, most recently, you reported to Kelly's CEO, you managed 40% of the total company annual revenue and 50% of the total company profit. You were promoted to only one of two operating president or EVP positions in the company. Teresa, you wore so many hats. You oversaw more than 2,500 people. You had 8 direct reports. And all of that was over the span of 27 years in the making. So looking back, which, you know, it's now in the position you're in to be able to kind of slow down and take a look back and breathe a little bit. Perhaps you could share with us on those years and looking back, what was one of your kind of most career defining moments that helped get you to where you are today? Does anything in particular stand out to you?
Leslie, there's so many things that I could probably say were career defining, the teams I've led, the people I've led, the teams I've worked with, but there are really two that stick out for me. So if you'll allow me, I'm going to talk about two. One is the fact, thank you. I actually led a team responsible for developing and launching Kelly Educational Staffing. So for those of you who don't know what Kelly Educational Staffing is, it is the provision of primarily substitute teachers through K through 12 schools. We launched it 20 years ago, and it created a whole new market in the industry. It was never measured before. It was never a market that staffing industry analysts talked about. It was never quantified in terms of market share, and we created that market, and Kelly is still the leader in that market. So that's probably one of my defining moments. And then more recently, while I've done several turnarounds, I also led the turnaround of Kelly Outsourcing and Consulting Group and turned it from a profit-losing segment to a market-leading, high-growth, very profitable segment of the company. And both of those moments come with great pride. I think about the teams that worked with me on that, the Saturdays, the nights, and all the things we had to do to create those moments. So those would be my career defining moments. And thank you for letting me have two.
Well, I bet we could have an entire podcast alone on the outsourcing and consulting group side of it, because so many companies today are continuing to try and find ways to have that kind of higher gross profit, higher margin, higher value add offering to clients. It's a nice mix with a traditional kind of staffing model. And so many clients or companies struggle with finding the way to make that happen or that balance, how to structure it, how to go to market with it, how to, you know, structure internally, how to message it, how to deliver something like that. So I know firsthand it is not an easy task. So congratulations on that, as well as your first defining moment. So both wonderful stories, but the second one in particular for me really resonates, because even today you hear so many companies trying to pull that off. And I know those listening, you may be getting a couple of phone calls about that and what you did and how it was so successful, because it really is a challenge and a struggle, but it's something that definitely is helping for those who are successful. It can add so much value, as you saw firsthand. I guess in the spirit of kind of looking back, so to speak, I always love to ask this question and understand, you know, if you could give advice to your younger you. And the funny thing is, when I think of the younger me, I think, wait a minute, aren't I still like the younger me? And somehow it goes by so flipping fast. But if you could kind of look at all, you know, the years in the industry, what advice would you look back and give yourself?
Yeah. Well, I wish I could say that I'm still the younger you, but I actually have spent half my life in the industry and at Kelly Services, so I'll let everybody do the math. I started in the industry at 27 years old. So when I look out into audiences and I see those millennials and soon to be zillennials, you know, in their 20s, I think that was me. I actually finished my MBA since I started in the industry and with Kelly. I've had two children. I've traveled the world logging over millions of miles. I've helped earn millions and millions of dollars for shareholders. I've received wonderful industry accolades. I've earned a great living for myself and my family. And I actually still enjoy a wonderful business network that is active and thriving. However, nothing compares to the 3-inch thick folder I have in my home office right now from when I stepped down from Kelly not too long ago, probably about 4 months ago. In this folder are copies of texts and emails and LinkedIn messages and tweets and cards and all kinds of wonderful messages from people who shared their personal stories of how I've impacted them and what they've learned from me. So when I think back, you know, to my younger self, I also think about, I have numerous messages from my 25-year-old daughter about the impact I've had on her. And I have one of my most treasured things from my son, who last International Women's Day, he wrote an Instagram post, a two-pager, and he's 22 years old now, that he wrote last year on what I mean to him on International Women's Day. So when I think about all these things, this is what I think about. I would tell my younger self, I would say, be your authentic self. It will be far more rewarding than trying to conform to what society and others may unconsciously or consciously bias you to be. I've always remained true to myself. Some people would say I'm probably too silly. Some people would say I'm too analytical. Some people would say I'm too serious sometimes. Some people would say all kinds of things, but that is who I am. And business and life, to me, they're all about people you impact. The rest will happen as a result. All the good things that come with impacting people, especially delivering and executing on a business plan, is going to happen only because you're impacting those people. So that's what I would tell myself. Be authentic and don't try to let other people bias you to be something other than that.
It's so easy to get in your head and think, you know, that you need to be a certain way based on other people's reactions. And it's much harder to be authentic sometimes in our society, which is so ironic. So I love that advice. And two things kind of come to mind. A page out of your book in my office, I wish you could see it right now. I keep every single card, no matter what is said about, like, it could be a small thank you or, you know, a super thoughtful note, but just to remember the people, because we go through this life in our careers and sometimes forget some of those stories. And I love that about you, that you do that, because it does bring back memories and things that you did and a reflection on the past and all of the people you've helped impact. So I'm glad to follow in your footsteps, and I will continue to do that. And I love your idea of, I need to print the emails and LinkedIn messages and tweets and add that in there, because it's so important to reflect on that. And I'd love to read, I don't know if it's public or not, but I may have to track down your son's Instagram post, because I have a 3-year-old son, and I'd love to read what your 22-year-old son has to say and reflect on that, because there's so much to learn from that.
It was a tearjerker. I would have to ask his permission to publicize it. Aww. But I woke up on the morning of a big pitch with a big client in a city, a nasty hotel. And it was there when I woke up. And I would say that anybody who has read it has cried. So you have to be ready to read it.
Oh my gosh, what a gift. That's something to be treasured for sure. And it actually speaks volumes to you just in the way and raising your children as well, that he would do that. So that's fantastic. So Teresa, while we were prepping, we talked a lot about the topic of networking, actually. So something we see quite often, I know I do, I co-founded a group called ARA. It's Attract, Retain, and Advance Women in Technology. We have about 6,000 men and women part of the program across the U.S. And one of the biggest challenges we see women face is confidence and giving up their network. And not paying as much attention to the network mid-career. Because if you think about it, you know, you first, when you leave college and when you're starting or whatever you're doing and you start your first job and your career, most people are of the same age. They may be single. They may be going out a little bit more and doing different things. And then just as you get to mid-career, your lives have just naturally changed. It may be more responsibilities at work or more responsibilities at home. Either way, it's often something that is impacted as kind of giving up on a network. So you're in an interesting position today to really leverage your network and tap into it really more than ever. And you speak at national conferences. Again, I've seen you keynote. You've been named the SIA's Global Power Top 100 Women in Staffing list for multiple years. You're part of the C200. And that's just to name a few things of many that you're involved with. But is there anything you would do differently to cultivate your network? Or on the flip side, are you particularly proud of the network you've built? And in some cases, maybe a combination of both. So again, some advice for others who perhaps are struggling to find the time and why it's so important. I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Well, this is where I will go back to my younger self, because where I am right now is thinking about what's next for me, which takes me right back to high school when you think about what do I want to be when I grow up. And I feel like I'm right back there. I'm like, what do I want to be when I grow up? I have a long time ahead of me yet. So my network is really my biggest pride and joy right now, even though I don't think it's perfect and there's things that I would do to enhance it. So one of my favorite sayings has always been, you don't start building your network at the time of need. You build it over time for when you need it. So I'm really enjoying the network that I've built over time, but I'm continuing to enhance it and add to it. And there was a professor at the University of Michigan that I heard once who talked about an A and a B network. So that would be my advice if I were back in high school or back 27 when I started at Kelly, or anybody at any phase in their career, is to think about it this way. He talks about an A network is your network that you probably talk to quite a bit. You've built relationships. I've been known to build relationships both within Kelly and in the industry. And you do build a big network from that. So these are your closest network people that you talk to. You probably talk to them more regularly than others. You reach out to them when you have need for help or support or assistance. But then there's a B network that you need to build as well. And the B network is the one that you have the harder time building. It's outside your normal sphere. By nature, it's less active. But if you do it successfully, your B network will be your most diverse in thinking. They'll be your biggest challengers. And it's going to be the most outside in when you need them. So the ones you may only talk to once a quarter, or that person that you saw, like you just said, Leslie, keynote at a conference, and you want to get to know them better, but you're afraid to go up and talk to them. So your B network, you have to work harder at. And my advice would be to draw out an A network and a B network and populate it with who you would put in each. And if your A network is exponentially larger than your B network, give up some of the time on your A network and focus on building more of your B network, because it's the B network that will likely be the most valuable to you when you need it. And I'm finding that to be true for me right now. My A network's wonderful, but the B network has really challenged me to think in different ways than my A network.
Oh, I love that. I've never heard that before. The one thing I have heard, and I will continue to borrow because it's a good reminder and I haven't heard it in a while, is you build it over time for when you need it, which is so true. And it pains me when I see people who are starting over later in their careers when they do need it and they just don't even know where to start. So they couldn't even map out an A or a B. The wonderful thing is that we do have such strong networks, those of us who foster them, that we're willing to pull those people in and help them however we can so they can recover from it. And then hopefully they'll continue to coach people as to why it's important to have it. But I love this theory of the A and B network. And as you're talking and I'm thinking about it, you're so right. I love cultivating the A, and I know myself I need to work on the B as well. And yeah, so thank you for that. That's a great story and analogy, one that I have not heard before. So on the podcast in a while, people will share some of their favorite resources with our audience for both professional, you know, and for personal development and inspiration. So when we were chatting and I was getting to know you, you mentioned a book that is a must read, and you shared with me about How Women Rise and how it's been a significant influence for you. And I believe it's something you bought for and even held a book club with your younger female leaders in your business resource group at Kelly. And just to quickly summarize, and I bet you'll do a better job talking about it, but I'll quickly summarize. The book suggests a 4-step process for letting go of habits that get in our way. And there are 12 habits to be specific. And they suggest perhaps, you know, you don't have to go all in with 12 at one time, but perhaps starting with just one habit rather than trying to change a lot of things at one time. And then also, which I think this is a brilliant move, is enlisting allies in your effort to help you shift the behavior. So the more people who know what you're doing and can help you get there while maintaining, you know, you don't want to let go of those distinctive strengths that you have. And when you told me about the book, again, it's called How Women Rise, you mentioned that there were specific habits that you see most often and that there were some that you know, really stuck out and struck you as well. So I'd love if you would share with us perhaps the top 5 habits you see most often that get in the way of the women you lead. And then a second follow-up is, if there was one habit out of the 12 where you felt you needed the most help, which would it be?
Okay, so this is where I have a lot of passion right now. This book only, I became aware of this book only probably a couple years ago. So it's a book that we use not only with our business resource group, but I used it with my daughter, and she started sharing it with others as well. So it fits any generation. It fits both females and males to understand some of the habits that do get in the way of females in their rise to leadership. It's written by Sally Helgeson and Marshall Goldsmith, and I just noticed that staffing industry at their executive forum in March, they're going to have Marshall Goldsmith as a keynote speaker. So I can't wait to hear him, maybe have him sign my book as well. But and my book is written all over. I have comments about where I have not done a good job with some of these habits. And so it's something that I hope I never lose. But let's start with the 5 that I saw most often in female leaders. And if any of the female leaders who work for me are listening, they're going to start laughing because they know we had direct conversations about many of these. But one of them is habit number 8. Which is called the disease to please. And unfortunately, it impacts women at home and at work. And I think there's probably a lot of people shaking their head right now saying, yep, I understand. But it involves being thoughtful and nice and making everyone around you feel good. You know, it's a question you have to ask yourself. Do you take all the action items on group tasks? Do you go for consensus versus making decisions? Do you have trouble delegating? While it may serve you well early in your career to please, it's not as good over time, as you need to demonstrate more direct decision making and leadership. So the disease to please would be one of the five. There's also habit number 9, which is minimizing. This is one of my favorites because I have a funny story with a colleague at Kelly. So minimizing is where if you're in a crowded meeting and people are still arriving to that meeting, do you signal them to sit next to you and you scoot yourself close to let them sit there? Do you scoot your chair to make more space? Do you make your space and you physically smaller? I want everybody to watch in their next meeting where that happens and notice that men don't do this. You know, we've probably heard about man spreading and how they take up space and all of that. So when we did a book club on this book, there was a woman who said, I see that all the time. So she and I would come into meetings, and when it would happen, we would purposefully not minimize, and we would, you know, leave our spread out papers, our computer, whatever, where exactly where it was, to just watch and see what would happen if we didn't minimize ourselves to let others in the room. Another way we minimize is, do you say I'm sorry a lot? To tell you a story, I have a leader, very high level leader, who says it all the time. She knows it. We've talked about it. I've threatened to make her pay a dollar every time she says it. But it's the thing we do where we just start almost every sentence with, I'm sorry, or we end the sentence with, I'm sorry. Or do we use wimp words like just and maybe, or I just need a minute of your time, or I just have one observation, or maybe this isn't important. Those are what we call wimp words. And I have a former male colleague who used to tell me to stop using wimp words early in my career. So thankfully, I think I've escaped that habit for a while. And then habit number 7, the perfection trap. I think this is like overstudying at college. So for any of you who may have done that, are you striving to be perfect? It's putting stress on you and your teams. Do you keep mired in details or create negativity because you're bothered by every little thing that is going wrong? Are you not focusing on what's going right? And are you setting yourself up for disappointment because nothing is perfect? So the perfection trap. Habit number 10, they call it the too much trap. This one I love as well, and I've had many conversations with women about this. Do you use too many words? I actually heard somebody say we should be like a doctor going on rounds. How few words can we use while we're in a meeting or in a situation, just like a doctor would, so he can get on to the next patient? This is a damned if you do and a damned if you don't behavior that women suffer from oftentimes more than men, because you might get feedback that you're too enthusiastic, or you have too much emotion, you use too many words, or you disclose too much. But sometimes if you pull back too much on that, it's kind of, again, going back to authentic self, it's taking away what you bring to the table. So vulnerability and authenticity can be perceived by many as too much, and that's what this habit is talking about. But I personally, and you'll hear later that I suffer from many of these, but I wouldn't change who I am in this area. So you have to decide if you're going to change who you are when you read the book. Habit number 2 would be the last one of the 5, and it's expecting others to spontaneously notice and reward your contributions. This one I kind of laugh at because I think we do this with our spouses or partners as well. We assume that they're going to see everything that we're doing or feel everything that we're feeling, or they know all the things that we've done. So do you find it awkward to talk with senior leaders about your accomplishments? What if they were to ask you in an elevator, what has been your accomplishments in the last month? Would you have an answer, or would you shy away from that? And do you lobby for bigger roles based on your accomplishments, or do you assume people should just notice your good work and reward you accordingly? So those are the 5 I have seen the most as I have led female leaders, but I see it in men here and there as well. But while I can relate to all these habits and I can see myself in all of them, I needed the most help along my career on habit number 7, which is the perfection trap. I think being an engineer made it worse. So as a female leader, research suggests that women have gender expectations that start very early in childhood. We've all heard it. We all know it. They then get reinforced in the workplace, which makes us vulnerable to the desire to be perfect. I know I felt this. I continue to feel it sometimes. And this and the disease to please by the authors are noted as the 2 greatest challenges facing female leaders. And according to these coaches, they rarely see perfectionism habits among male clients. So my call to all of you is, if you haven't already gone on Amazon to order the book, or you haven't already read it, is to, I don't get commission, so don't think that I do, but get the book, put notes in it, and agree, like you said, Leslie, focus on one at a time and really get an ally if you can and try to change some of these behaviors. Only the ones, though, that you want to change. Don't change who you are authentically.
That's great advice, the piece about don't change who you want to be. Just, you don't want to impact at all. And as it said, while maintaining your distinctive strengths, because while it may be perceived to some as a weakness, it's certainly something that you can turn into and would be considered a strength for you. I don't know about those listening, but I certainly was nodding my head quite a bit at these habits, not only for myself, but a lot of people who I, you know, work with or coach or help mentor. The disease to please, I mean, being, we are a company of people pleasers, and there's definitely a balance between, you know, wanting to make people happy and, you know, just kind of doing the right thing and delegating and all of those things. So I love this. I'm going to take to heart this feedback and the advice that you've given with each of these. And actually, we do lunch and learns and different clubs through ARA as well. And this will certainly be one of the books that we highly recommend. And I'll start quoting as well. So thank you for bringing it to my attention. I had never heard of it. So I really appreciate that. I'm learning so much from you, Teresa. Thank you.
Well, if you called me at the beginning, I wanted to be a teacher, but I couldn't afford college, so I went to be an engineer. So teaching is in my blood.
Well, I'm glad you never changed that habit, because it's definitely one of your great strengths. So thank you for that. So, Teresa, making trade-offs is a familiar territory for professional women. And according to ARA, again, the group that I co-founded, we do an annual survey with Harvey Nash. And this is to men and women who participate. And actually, we've learned over the years, interestingly, that both men and women equally struggle with balancing family and outside work, life and career. And I know someone you and I both know mutually, Dana Lukaramoto, she calls it harmonious integration. So work-life balance, harmonious integration, whatever you'd like to call it. It seems like women still, again, in our survey, while both men and women are impacted by it, women still report that they feel like it holds them back much more than men. As a business leader and a mom of two children, do you believe we have to make trade-offs? It's funny asking this question and knowing, you know, kind of how you'll probably answer in the type of role that you've been in, but just to share with people, because again, this is all about learning and growing. Do you believe we have to make trade-offs? And how do you coach the women on your teams or even your daughter about thinking differently about reaching your goals, that you can do both? You can have a stellar career and have a healthy life. And by healthy, I mean, you know, mental health, physical health. I'd also be curious to know if you feel like this has perhaps changed over time. I mean, I remember a time at work in the corporate world when I first got it started in staffing, where it was like people were watching who's coming and going when, and it was, you know, very strict and quote unquote corporate-y. But it seems like today people are much more understanding than perhaps in the past due to an increased level of importance placed on flexibility. So I guess looking at that, how have you been able to do that? And what advice do you give to women who you're coaching?
Before I jump into the direct answer to the question, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, if I do ever let my son's Instagram post be publicized, for those who are young mothers who think, oh my gosh, I'm not doing it right, you will always feel that way. That's just mom guilt. But he talked about in that post, and my daughter talks about it as well, you know, they don't remember what you did wrong. They remember what you did right. So I would say, take the stress off. Forget the guilt and just make sure you do all the right things when you need to do them. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I find this question so interesting because my daughter, as I mentioned, is 25, and I recently had a chance to talk with her about balance and how she should think about trade-offs. She was stressing about her work and social life and some other things, and she was trying to figure out how she should think about those trade-offs. And one difference for her, though, is that she has somebody like me to talk to regarding work-life integration. You know, you have to remember that my generation, and definitely myself, we typically grew up with a mother who didn't understand the world of work outside the home. And similarly, my generation had far fewer mothers and female leadership groups available to us who understood it versus what's available today. I do believe work-life integration is so individual and so personal. what one person may want in their integration may be far different than what another wants. So I'm always very careful not to generalize. And when I coach women or daughters, I try to listen and I ask more questions about what they want versus telling them how I achieved it for myself. Because trust me, there were many times I wasn't achieving it very well for myself. And that probably takes us back to that perfectionist trap that I mentioned earlier. We could probably do a whole podcast on that for women. But I do think it has changed over time. I actually have some dear, dear friends who worked for me at Kelly over time who recently told me that I was one of the first ones to let them work from home. And this was probably 10 or 15 years ago. So I think it has changed over time and employers are far more accommodating to flexibility and various work arrangements. And thank goodness technology has really enabled this. So if you aren't feeling that you have the work-life integration because your company isn't allowing you to have it due to technology or other factors, I would, you know, really talk about it at your work about what you can do to get some of that technology into your business. But the other thing I would tell you is I love the podcast with Joyce Russell. So if you haven't heard it, she mentioned the 10-10-10 decision-making process. And I believe every decision that anybody makes about work-life integration should be made with that criteria. So I love it. I'm not going to repeat it here. Your listeners will have to listen or re-listen to her podcast to understand what I mean. But she had a really good way of thinking about decision-making. And I think that decision-making criteria can be definitely applied to work-life integration and trade-offs.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's so fascinating. And then again, for those listening, Joyce Russell was a guest on our podcast On the Edge, and we talked to her, and Joyce runs the foundation for ADECO today. That is her most current role. And we had her on the podcast when she was in her role prior. And I heard her twice keynote at an event talking about the 10-10-10 decision-making process. And each time you could see in the room, and she tears up when she tells it as well, but people just really, it really impacting them. And I know for me, when I interviewed her, I had just been through something in my own life. And to your point, like they remember the good things and not necessarily the bad things. And, you know, my son is so little, but I was interviewing her when I was just heading on like a 7-day business trip. And it was the longest I was going to be away from him. And I was really, really, really struggling with it. And this whole, you know, the decision you make and the impact it'll have in the next 10 minutes, 10 months or 10 years, and to really think that through, it has helped me in my decision-making process to realize, you know, at the time he was like, I don't know, 1.5, 2. He has no idea that I'm leaving right now. So it's probably okay. But later in life, if something like that were to come up, and to your point, things that are really important, it's important to take that into consideration. One thing that I love about what you said is one thing to ask people for advice and to listen to what people do. Your life is different than my life, and my life is different than your life. I had children really late in life. I'm 47 and have a 3-year-old. And the way I run my company, we have 42 people, and we've from day one had people working all over the U.S. In fact, I have a head of digital strategy who's right now living out of an RV with her fiance. And I what I try to do is just lead by example for them so they know I live a really, try to live a very healthy life and want to give them permission to do the same. But also I know that each one of our lives are extraordinarily different and I don't want to ever judge someone for something because you never know what's happening in someone's life. So it's easy to kind of give feedback and advice, but to your point, you kind of take in what makes sense and you leave out what doesn't because everyone's life is so much different. So with that, confidence, this is something, Teresa, that I know people, you know, struggle with, and a lot of women struggle with this. And, you know, you've really risen the corporate ladder, you know, taking different paths and have been in such a fantastic, you know, leadership position in our industry. Again, as Robin said, an icon in our industry. And again, just looking at this and thinking of yourself, where you came from, I'm really curious, and I love asking this question, is did you always look in the mirror and think, I will be an executive one day? Have you ever felt like you weren't good enough? And if so, how did you overcome any of that self-doubt? I like to call it the evil DJ, which I can't take credit for. My sister had told me about it through a podcast, but that constant negative voice in your head that just keeps playing the same tune over and over. How did you get that self-doubt out of your head and really put yourself out there and advocate for yourself?
The imposter syndrome. So I've had imposter syndrome many times. I just choose to call it Midwest humble Catholic guilt. That's what I usually tell people. I have a lot of humble Midwest Catholic guilt that you could easily say is the imposter syndrome. But it wasn't until mid or later in my career when I had more responsibility and more numbers on the board, though, that I was able to advocate for myself. Probably, again, whether it's because I'm an engineer or an operator by nature, I wanted to be able to use numbers to be able to say, you know, why I should achieve certain levels in a company or why I should be recognized or why my team should be recognized. But once I had those, I was able to advocate for myself and became more confident and willing to claim achievements, which, by the way, is one of the habits, is being willing to claim achievements. So probably the most important thing I learned is to claim these achievements more for my leaders, though, and for my teams, versus for myself. If you think about it, when you're a leader, you're the best and sometimes the only PR machine for your team and your leadership. And if you don't scream it from the rooftops, how do you expect others to know? So while I would humble way not want to talk about achievements as much or be as confident, it wasn't until in my head I flipped the switch to, no, I am their PR agency, that I decided to start being much more vocal about claiming achievements. And I think that really helped also with my own confidence, because I would gather the numbers more and say, wow, look at what we have achieved, and this is great, and tell the story of our achievements. So that's what I would recommend, is to think about it more as you are the PR agency, either for yourself or for your team, and that might help with confidence.
And something you said earlier about kind of your own career too, is making sure, and this is one of the habits, being your own career champion. So just putting yourself out there and being that PR machine, as you said, can really make a difference. I agree. So Teresa, I know inquiring minds want to know what's next for you. Maybe share with us a little bit about what you're up to.
Well, what does one do after 35 years in big companies? Well, I'm exercising better. Great. I'm eating better, which is great. But what I'm really doing is I'm working on a discovery process that I call Operation Authentic Self. And again, I told you earlier, remember when you were in high school and you thought, what am I going to be when I grow up? That's what I'm doing, trying to figure it out. And I have to admit, it's actually been very hard, probably because I'm an activator. I'm forcing myself to discover what's out there and to not act on everything that comes my way quite yet. That's not easy to do. It's very hard for my personality, but it has allowed me to think broader and to think deeper about what really energizes me. And I encourage anybody to take the time to do that. I have looked into everything from coaching, consulting, being a professor. Remember, I wanted to be a teacher, speaking, writing a book, all the way to CEO roles and getting on more boards. So because I am still in my discovery process, those inquiring minds are going to have to wait, because I don't have an answer yet. I'm giving myself a little bit more time. I'm leveraging my A and B networks, and I'm increasing them to have them challenge me and help me in my process of diversity of thought. And I'm trying very hard to take risks and be agile and be innovative in my thinking. So for those of you out there who know me well enough, I welcome you to weigh in on my what's next. And then I'll keep everybody posted via my LinkedIn account when I figure it out. I do tell my husband that I'm Paul Carroll's wife, and he kind of laughs and others laugh, because that's probably not a job that I can do full time.
Well, I am sure you just kind of opened Pandora's box. You may be getting a lot of inquiries out there. And to your point, everyone, you know, could use you. You help turn around the consulting business, and there's just so many opportunities that it would be very easy, I could imagine, to want to feel like you could act on everything. And I give you a lot of credit to kind of quiet the activator in you and really focus on that Operation Authentic Self. You deserve it for as long as you've been in the industry and the impact that you've made, to take that time for yourself to pick what's next and the best what's next for you. So we are just about out of time, Teresa. So this podcast, thank you everyone for listening. I know that we're running longer than usual. I feel like I'd be remiss not to ask you a question about equality, just because this is a podcast for executive women in recruitment, although I know everyone is welcome to and listens to the podcast. But I have to say, recently this statistic came to me, and I wanted to share with you and just get your thoughts on what kind of action-oriented steps can we take to make change in equality. And the World Economic Forum projects that equality in the U.S., that it's still another 208 years away. And I had to really digest that statement when I first heard 208 years. As I mentioned, my son Grayson's only three. And I kind of naively thought all these efforts that I was doing and all these things we were going through and all these groups and mentoring and changes and everything, that it would, you know, just help, that we would see changes that we're making today lead to equality for his generation. But 208 years is six generations, really. He wouldn't even see it. Our great grandmothers fought for the right to vote in the U.S., and that was officially on August 26, 1920. That was just 100 years ago. So 208 more years. So, Teresa, I'd love to hear from you, a female executive who you are probably the closest woman I know to becoming the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, which there are only 33 women on that list. What is the one thing everyone in our industry can do to impact change?
So I can tell you the women in the 80s who were, you know, trying to pave the way back when I was starting out thought that it wouldn't take that long. And I'm sad to hear that it's going to take that long. So what I would say is change the trajectory. Think big. I think if we think big, if we are authentic selves, if we force inclusivity, and most importantly, execute well on what we think needs to happen, and we remember it's all about the people we impact, I think the rest will happen as a result. There's a movement underway in so many different areas of the world and industry and business and politics and everything else. So there is a movement. So we just need to keep thinking big, and we need to keep pushing that movement forward and making sure that it's getting some momentum. And that's how I would say we have to make change.
Yep. I'm not even going to think about the number, because it's all in the people we impact. And as you said, the rest happens as a result. So we will get there. Teresa, let's say someone's listening to the podcast and they'd like to reach you. What is your preferred method for that?
Well, I would prefer people reach out on LinkedIn. So that is an area where I'm able to at least apply responses and get back to people. I also am on Twitter at Teresa S. Carroll. I have not been as active as I've been in my discovery phase, but I may get more active in the new year. So Twitter, if you want to follow me, at Teresa S. Carroll, and LinkedIn, send me a message and I will get back to you. Maybe not the same day, but soon thereafter.
Fantastic. Teresa, I cannot thank you enough for being on the Edge podcast. It is an absolute pleasure to have you as a guest. It has been wonderful to get to know you. And like I said, I learned so much from you from our past conversation and today, and I look forward to continuing to learn from you in your next chapter.
Well, thank you, Leslie. To you and your team, have a great 2020. To all your listeners, have a great 2020. I know I will.
Fantastic. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to The Edge. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate and subscribe to it in iTunes. Feel free to email Leslie at lvickery@clearedgemarketing.com and let us know if you have questions, would like to be a guest, or suggest a potential guest, or share topics you'd like to see in the future.